Hello, everybody, and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. All three of us are professional illustrators, and for the last about 25 years, we've all worked for just about every major publisher there is, and we've published together about 50 books, 50 children's books, and have all taught illustration at the university level.
Each week, we're going to tackle a subject relating to the field of illustration from our three perspectives. Sometimes we're going to agree, sometimes we're going to argue, but every time you will learn something new.
Not every time.
Every time. Guaranteed.
I'm pretty sure. I hope so. Some people might learn not to listen to this podcast.
I think they're skipping the intro and just going right in.
Yeah, probably. So, this episode, if you haven't noticed, we have new bumper music, or is that what it's called, bumper music?
Mm-hmm. Bumper cars.
This is a track Will Terry picked out himself. So good job, Will Terry.
Thank you.
Yeah, let us know if you guys like it or not. Okay. Lee, the topic is on you today. Let's dive into it. I'm really curious to see what you have to say about this. It was kind of interesting hearing your thoughts on this.
Yeah. So this one's going to be, just like all of them, we don't have them really planned out that well. But that's not a good way to say that. We have an unscripted podcast. And this one deals with the topic that I think happens a lot in the everyday life of an artist, and that is failure. It's become, as we talk about our successes, kind of inextricably linked with that is failure, and the two kind of go hand in hand. And so I thought it'd be fun to talk about, what does it mean to fail, and how do you move on from it? Is there any common threads, I guess, between the failures that we've all had, and how we got through it, and then what happened after it, and all that kind of stuff. And so the way that I see it, I thought I'd intro this by talking, kind of framing maybe how this podcast will go, but it kind of wanders along anyway. But there's three kind of failures that I see, and that is a low level failure, which is small daily failures or small daily letdowns, not life threatening, but that stings a little bit, like any kind of a letdown or a failure. Mid-level failures, there's bigger setbacks. They sting for a much longer period, a week, a month, or something like that. They don't necessarily derail you all the way, but it hurts. And then you've got those high-level failure where it's like getting fired, getting divorced, instances that are totally life-changing. And so that's kind of the light framework that I think I'm going to hang this topic on. But I do think it's interesting, and I'd like to start out with people who succeeded, a good quote. Any good podcast already starts with a quote. So here's the quote. People who succeed are people that failed, but they kept going anyway. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I really love it because I really do think that's true. And so as I started doing research for this topic, certain things kept coming up. I kept seeing them over and over. A lot of them deal with sports figures just because they're so linked to success, especially iconic sports figures. And one of them, so I'll go through a couple of those here. So Muhammad Ali, most of you guys probably know some of these things, but Muhammad Ali lost his first fight, and after the fight was still saying how he's going to be the heavyweight champion of the world. That's one of my favorite stories. It just goes so well with him that he loses and is like, I'm going to be the champion. it's awesome. Michael Jordan did not make his 10th grade basketball team. A lot of people know that. And then he came back to be a pretty good basketball player, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's so
when
good.
When you're not even good enough for high school, right. And you end up becoming the best pro in the world.
Right. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Not bad, but that really fueled him. I mean, if you guys have ever looked into kind of the biography of him, it really did fuel him. It lit the fire. And so I really do think that failure is the impetus for his success. But he had still, even, that's just one, that would be like a big level success, or excuse me, failure for him. But he had a lot of small failures, even while he was the superstar. For example, at one time, he had the most, for a success, he had the most makes of shots within the last 5 seconds of a game. So very successful, mm-hmm. giving him the ball the last, 5 seconds of the game. He also had the highest percentage of misses for that same time frame. So it was really a crapshoot whether he was going to make it or not.
Right.
But we only remember the ones that he hit. Babe Ruth, same thing. He had the home run record at the same time he had the strikeout record for 5 years straight. And he, wow, he was also known as the king of strikeouts. He had like five times more strikeouts than any other player in those years when he was playing.
That's really interesting. So his success is that he just went for it every time.
He was all or nothing.
All or nothing. Wow. He wasn't shooting for, he didn't want a double or a triple or a single. He only wanted home runs.
Right. I mean, he's how much of a badass are you when you point at over the wall telling people you're going to hit a home run? That's just so next level kind of stuff. But okay, so I thought we'd maybe start on the low level failures.
Wait, what would be the children's book illustration version of pointing over the wall before you?
That'd be announcing to people on social media that you're going to win the Caldecott before they announce it.
It'd be your Twitter profile would say
future Caldecott winner.
Future Caldecott winner or Caldecott winner 2020.
I think I'm just going to change all of my social media statuses to Caldecott winner. I mean, there's no law against that.
Just put a question mark behind it.
Possible Caldecott winner. There's no problem. I'm going to do that today. That'd be fun just to see how that plays out. I bet I'd get a lot of emails with people, the fact checkers. There's always your internet fact checker people that always know everything, and they double check me. You didn't win anything. They'd say it real mean.
Right.
Okay, so low-level failures. These are small daily failures, not life-threatening. Stings just a little bit. I'll give you guys an example and see what, and then each of you can add to the story. So I came to art school from not having any experience really in drawing and painting at all. And so every day while I was in school, and it was fun for me to actually go through this process and this topic to remember back on that, because I do remember some of the successes and things I had during school, but there was a lot, especially during the first maybe three or four terms, where I really had no idea what I was doing. And so I was kind of looking around. The teacher would give an assignment, we'd all bring them in, and I didn't know what the level was, but everybody around me were like Jake and Will. Like, everybody had been painting their whole life and drawing their whole life. They all knew what they were doing, and they had preferences, and they had the lingo down, and I didn't have any of that. And so every day, especially those first couple of terms, I just sulked into class. I would think I had a good painting, and then I'd put it up, and then the person next to me would set theirs up, and I would know immediately. I mean, I did have at least a realistic viewpoint of the quality there. And it was just disheartening where I just couldn't do it. I didn't have enough experience. I didn't know the media well enough. And so it was a daily failure for me those first couple of terms, I thought. And it was tough, and I was really struggling with it in school. And so how I got through that was I basically set a long distance goal, and that way I could kind of push the failure stigma off of me for a little while. And so I came up with an idea my first term to do 100 paintings. And once I get to the 101st painting, that's when I'm going to start judging what I'm doing. But until then, I'm just going to count it. Like, every painting, I just had a number, and I just made a tick mark on my little sheet. And that was that was painting number 10. That was painting number 12. That was painting number 15. And I didn't really judge it too much after that point. And I was just shocked at how much that little technique helped.
That's a good strategy.
Yeah, that's really cool.
It got me through it.
I think that one of the problems that we have with failure, well, two problems, is one, we call things failures that are not really failures. Like for instance, a painting that doesn't turn out or that gets a bad grade. And I'm talking about when you're in art school or maybe high school, you try your best or you try fairly hard and you get a bad grade. And so you look at it as, well, that one was no good. That was a failure. I think we've been, the other problem is, I think we've been conditioned away from using failure or trial and error as a way to move forward. So by that, I mean, in school, we don't really get good grades for trying. We don't get good grades for trying and failing, or the experiments that don't turn out. We get our papers marked down. And so all the results that we're looking for in our report card are only up. They're just, they're just based on, what kind of grades did you get? Were they really good? I think that conditions us in a bad way to be artists. I think that works for some disciplines, like, for instance, like math. It's either right or wrong. But with a painting, you could make a lot of strokes that are heading the right way, and then you don't necessarily know where you went wrong, but then you get to a point where it's unrecoverable. Like, for instance, like an oil painting, where you get too much oil paint on your canvas, and the only thing you can do to fix it is really to scrape it off or start over completely,
Right.
But the marks that you made were part of the journey that gets you to where, like you said, you said you weren't going to count it until, or you weren't going to judge yourself until you got through 100 of them. Mm-hmm. And what you probably realized is you need even more than 100,
Oh yeah. Right. Just a starting point. But by 100, I was pretty good. I mean, at that point I had full scholarships and I was starting to find my stride. At least it wasn't life and death kind of thing. It wasn't just the stigma of daily failure.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't really have a solution for that idea that you are, or that we condition our kids to, I don't know if I talked about this on this podcast before, but I have had a student one time who wouldn't try anything with paint because he was so afraid to make something a bad mark that he just was paralyzed. Mm-hmm. And I really think that comes from not being ever rewarded for trying and failing.
Well, that brings up a weird thing, because right now there's a, there's a lot of dialogue with kids and how they learn, and specifically in sports, where we're awarding participation trophies, and then we aren't actually given the real trophies to the winners. And there's a lot of dialogue about that. Some people for it, some people against it. What do you guys think about that?
Well, personally, like, regardless if a kid gets a participation award or not, they know that a game is being played and there's an actual winner. Like,
yeah, like they're the not kids stupid. Deep down
know. What yeah, you can. Yeah, you stupid. Can try to hide it from them, but they know. They know who won and who lost, even if the score was tied.
But my kids have participation awards. They don't value them or cherish them or anything. They come home with them and forget them as easily as they got them. Mm-hmm. So, as far as like getting back to the crux of it, like, I think too with failure, there's also, You have the three levels, like low level, medium level, and high level. But there's also failure where it's all on you. So it's failure caused by choices you have made. Mm-hmm. There's also failure caused by choices other people have made that have influenced the failures that you've had. And then there's external forces, which aren't caused by anybody, but it's just, something, a twist of fate, something bad happened.
Right.
And it's caused you to fail. And I think depending on which kind of failure you're experiencing depends on the reaction you have depends on what kind of failure is going on there. And typically my personal thing is, regardless of what caused the failure, I'm going to try and take as much responsibility for either for what happened or for fixing the situation moving forward. I think that's kind of the lesson to be taken from any sort of failure, is that you've learned something, you learned what hasn't worked. And so you can like check that off the list and know, okay, this sort of thing isn't going to work. So I don't have to try this anymore. Now I'm going to try something else and get this to work.
Right. That's kind of the experiment method of dealing with failure, which I love that, where you're basically testing hypothesis and you tinker. And so there is really no failure. It's basically like, okay, I worked through those theories and they didn't work. And so I'm going to change the process or change the program in some way. Mm-hmm. That's a good way. That's how I actually learned to paint in watercolor. Because watercolor, I still think watercolor is hard and I know it pretty well at this point. And I still think it is so difficult. And when I was first learning to do it, I failed a massive amount with it. I mean, almost every painting I would fail at it. You're using these big sheets of paper that are really expensive. And so I just felt terrible every time I was doing it. And I had one painting that I had it in my head. I had some nice little studies of it and I really wanted to do it. And so I started basically painting with the idea that every painting is a test. And if I just happen to get a good one, then that's the finish. But I never went into a watercolor painting think it's the final one. I mean, that little shift of thinking took the idea of, oh man, I wrecked that piece of paper. I'm a terrible watercolor painter to, all right, didn't put enough water down. Okay, the next one, I got to add more water. You know, really did change the mental conversation I was having.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. I think too, I was reading, I don't know if this is an article I read or something I heard on an audiobook or something, but scientists, especially rocket scientists, like cherish and even look forward to a rocket like failure, a rocket blowing up, right? Because if a rocket goes off and gets sent into orbit without any hitches, then you don't know if you got lucky or if everything works
right.
Exactly as planned. But if a rocket blows up, now you have all this data that you can go through and see, okay, you know, we know that X, Y, and Z worked, but we know that A, B, and C malfunctioned right before this happened, and that's what caused this thing to blow up. And so then they could go through that and they could fix that problem. So the next time when the rocket goes off without a hitch, now they know for sure, okay, this wasn't luck, this was us knowing that, you know, the problems we had before have been taken care of and cleared up. And so if you look at failure that way, and if you look at success that way, you know, it changes your perspective. And I sometimes get worried when things go off without a hitch and, you know, I have a really successful like launch of something, or, you know, whether it's a Kickstarter or a print sale that I'm doing or a pre-order or anything like that, because I don't know if I'm just getting lucky and all these people are showing up, you know, for some external reason that I didn't cause, right, or if it's something that I'm like in control of, because mm-hmm. I really want to know.
That's the experience that I had with the launching those first eBooks on Amazon and Barnes and Noble. I got there right when they allowed you to upload a book. You know, it costs mm-hmm. nothing. You know, you create an account, you make your eBook file, you make the artwork for the cover, you know, you size it and you just upload it to their site. I mean, I had to fill out some forms with bank account information, but I mean, that took an hour or so. And then started sharing it on social media, and, you know, there weren't any books on their site at that time. And so they just started selling. I think on my best day, I sold 413 books of Mickey and Croc. Nice. And that's like, I mean, I'm just looking at this is like, I'd get on my phone and I would log in. I was addicted to it for a while every day just to see how many books sure. I was selling, you know? And I was like, well, if I can do this good, and I'm not going to go into this whole story because I've talked about it on this podcast before, but that's why I did the iPad apps. And I went in thinking, well, I could probably reproduce that same success if I added animation and added sound and added, you know, a better story and better artwork. And I just, more is going to be better, so more will translate into more sales. And it was the exact opposite. And that failure hurt.
Why did it fail?
People don't buy iPad apps. I mean, that's
the free ones.
That's the simple answer, is somehow people value an ebook that does nothing, you know, for a Kindle. And I think the publishers are responsible for that, and good for them. They protected their assets, you know, and they basically just said, yeah, we're not going to release our content for $1 or $2 or $3. You're going to pay the same price for it. And a lot of us didn't think they'd be successful in doing that when they first did it. We thought, the market forces will drive it down, but they cornered the market on the good books. And so, you know, if people wanted to read it on their Kindle or on their Fire or whatever they had, iPad, they had to pay about the same amount. I think it was a dollar or two cheaper than a book, you know. So
that's so funny that people would pay for one version but not the other, and it's essentially the same thing. Or
better, the iPad apps for kids are better,
right?
I mean
it's just a difference in culture, I guess, or how people think about it,
right? They're not, I shouldn't say that, from a book standpoint, they're not better, because, like, I guess what I'm saying is you can do different things with them. You can create a thing that you can't do in a book.
Right.
So I think the good iPad apps had animations that made sense and that created activities or created learning that used the interactivity in a good way. There's plenty of bad ones, plenty of superfluous animation, and but definitely a different beast, but it just didn't take off.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I have a label, by the way, that talking about, I guess kind of what we're talking about here definitely goes along with what Jake was saying about the rocket guys. And that term is called failing forward. Have you guys ever heard that term before?
Yeah, there's a book called Failing Forward.
Is that, I just wrote it down. I don't know if I was referencing the book or not. What's the book about?
Failing forward.
I mean, is that its context? Is that basically that
to learn certain things, you have to fail. Like, you can't become a good painter. You can't, you know, to go to the MMA references, you can't learn to wrestle or box or fight or anything without getting hit.
Right.
And if you...
Yeah, the subtitle is Turning Mistakes into Stepping Stones for Success.
Oh, that's great. I didn't even know that was going to go there, but yeah, right in line with what I was thinking. I mean, you have to fail, like you're saying. You cannot move it forward. And it's just a series of failures. It's just kind of weird when you look at it under that kind of lens. I can't believe that people continue doing this. Yeah. I'm thinking about quitting right now.
I remember, you know, showing my wife an assignment for school and the look on her face when she didn't like it. And I would get angry, not at her. I mean, she could tell that I was upset, and, you know, sometimes she would say, like, you can't get upset if you want my honest opinion, because I'm not going to give you the honest opinion if I see that you're getting upset at it. And I'm like, but it's upsetting to work this hard and not be able to have something that I can't even impress you with, you know? And she's like, well, you got to keep working then, you know? And I remember using that anger to go, okay, what did I do wrong? Why doesn't this look as good as painting that I'm looking at, or the, you know, my,
yeah, why didn't it get the same reaction that you have when you're looking at your reference and all the other
reference, or maybe it. I did a pinnacle piece that was way better and it got a lot of and impressed her, and then I would take steps backwards because I wasn't as good as that piece that I got lucky on, you know? Right. And I think every artist kind of knows that sometimes you get lucky in the beginning with, you know, sometimes you do things that people really respond to, but you don't necessarily know why. And you're not at a point where you can actually recreate that.
Dealing with family in this career is one of the hardest things ever. I know that David Hone has, me and him have joked about that a lot, because he'll bring something home. His wife's was a graphic designer for Nike and really good. She knows what she's talking about. And he had a high bar when he would go home and show her artwork. Lisa always makes fun of, or not makes fun of, but always comments on a character in every one of my pieces. I show her a piece, she'll be like, oh, I love it. You know, she'll have that kind of, you know, whether she likes it or not, I don't know, but she seems excited about it most of the time. And then, well, her eyes kind of funny. Her hair looks a little bit weird. Like every time I just wave, I'm just cringing in the back of my head. Now I'm like, okay, go ahead. What's wrong with the character? Yeah. It's every time. See,
that's Allison too. She will always be straight up honest. Like, I don't like it, you know.
I can see her saying that, by the way.
Yeah. And I sometimes have to go into this and saying, okay, this is not for, you know, middle-aged women, you know, moms with five kids. This is for 20-year-old men who have a, you know, are either in school or their first job. This is who I'm trying to appeal to with this particular drawing.
You're basically doing the kid version. Like, you don't know nothing.
Well, I'll come into that. And she's all, well, I don't like it, but yeah, maybe they might, you know.
And you know that doesn't feel any better, no matter how much. Right. You...
But when it is something she likes, she is all in on it. And she's like, this is so good. You know, why aren't you doing more of stuff like this? This is,
yeah. Why aren't you?
Why aren't you any good all the rest of the time?
Anyways, I value her opinion. That's the thing. It's like, I also like would show stuff to my mom growing up, and she loved everything. And pretty soon I got to notice that like I wasn't getting actual like honest critiques, because she did. Well, maybe it was an honest critique, but I knew that if I needed my ego like boosted, to show it to my mom. But if I really wanted to improve and get better, my mom wasn't the one to show it to.
Mm. I think family, direct family, like parents can have one of two reactions. It's either that they love everything no matter what it is, or they kind of don't like anything. And you know, I remember one specific time I was in high school. For some reason, I wanted to draw my dog. I had this German Shepherd, and I wasn't drawing every day or anything. This is just something like one day. It was raining outside, so I couldn't go ride my bike or skateboard. And so I did this drawing of the dog. And I was pretty happy with it, and I showed my mom, and she's like, "He looks deranged." And I was like, "Thanks, Mom."
And those random comments make you second guess your work so much.
Oh man.
I used to get the comment that my kids look like old people, and they did, and it bothered me that sometimes the truth hurts. So it would make me angry to get that comment, even though I knew it was true. Have you ever had that where you're like, you know, it's true, but you, and I was like, what? You know, I remember telling my wife before, like, well, I don't know how to make them young. You know,
what was the problem? So looking back on it, how'd you fix it?
I didn't understand eye placement. I didn't understand how big the forehead needed to be. So one, the eyes were in the adult locations. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like they weren't exaggerated to, you know, have the nose down lower. And I would, you know how beginning painters, they see too many details.
Right.
And so I would put lines, you know, like fold lines where, you know, adults have them on kids, and you can see them there in kids, but it's that thing where what you know is actually the problem, you know, because you know it. So you start to draw it, but really it's something that you should be de-emphasizing or eliminating completely.
Mm-hmm. There's two things specifically that I recognize from beginner drawings from teaching, and that is when people draw a line, like a hard line for the collarbone, or a hard line for the sternocleidomastoid muscle, that big muscle that goes from the little V in your neck up to the back behind your ear.
Neck muscle.
Mm-hmm. The neck muscle. That's an easier way of saying sternocleidomastoid. But I've just noticed it a lot. That's an interesting thing that. And you're exactly right. Everybody sees all these lines everywhere, and they just say, okay, I got to draw them. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, yeah, you've aged your character.
Yeah. And I could not see it. It used to drive me crazy. And then one day I made one that looked young, and my wife's like, now that looks like a kid. And so I used to use that drawing. I was like, okay, just do that.
Keep doing that.
Again. And then I couldn't get, you know, I didn't have the skill to really analyze what was going on. So it took years before I could actually consistently do that. That's a frustrating thing. You know what? Those are little failures that are constantly aggravating you. And
Do you know what comment gets my goat?
What's that?
Like every, I try to be cool. Like, whatever. It's when you draw an original character that you've pulled it out of the zeitgeist, or it's, you know, you're thinking, oh, it'd be cool if I put these two elements together and made something new. You draw it, you post it online, and someone says, oh, you've been watching X. You know, oh, is this character from, you know, from this show? And I just want to be like, no, I created it myself, and I didn't watch that, and I didn't copy it. And I can have an original idea, and I can have an original thought. You know, I don't know if it's like, if this is something like creeping in from being a kid and like kids would say, oh, you're just copying that. You don't know really how to draw tracing.
But I can't wait to say that on every drawing I see from you now.
I knew it. I knew I shouldn't have said it.
we're just giving each other ammo in this, in this episode.
But those are kind of failures, right?
They are definitely failures. Is there speaking to wanting to please the people directly around you, if your significant other or whoever that is to you, that you want them to like the piece, if they don't like the piece, but everybody else still does like the piece, does it ever become a successful piece in your head? Or is it sort of a failure just because that person that you want it to like it does it?
Yep. It's always marred by that.
It's got an asterisk.
Somebody can really do a head job on artists, can't they?
It's so easy.
Yep.
Little backhanded comments. Mm-hmm. So be careful. Almost sting. Yeah.
Be careful who you ask. Don't ask your spouse.
We used to joke around when I was at art. We'd have this portfolio day where everybody'd hang their stuff or whatever. And we would think of just these fun. This was just done as a joke. This was not something we actually did, but like backhanded compliments.
Oh, yeah, I love it.
It was so good. We came up with one, like we'd walk around and be like, oh man, this looks really good. I can't wait till you take perspective.
Yeah.
You know, just these like a little, we never actually said it. I want to put that out there. These are just, we were talking about this in at Art Center because these little comments.
I love how you broke her arm so that, you know, people with broken arms can feel included.
Oh, that's good. That's pretty good. I got some notes here. I'll throw this out there. What about instances where a small personal failure, like say maybe you actually don't like the piece, but it gets accepted by your publisher, by your teacher, whoever you have to turn work into. Maybe everybody else just generally likes it and you don't like it. How do you get through that? Or is there anything you adjust after that? Or how do you do that?
Let me tell you this. So I drew a cover to my graphic novel, Skyheart.
This one again.
Did we already do this?
I think I'm going to be used as a springboard for. I have a feeling.
No, but listen, I drew this cover to Skyheart, and I was happy with it at the time because I actually drew the cover before I drew the book. And I was using the cover as a way to sell the book on the Kickstarter and as a way for me to like familiarize myself with the characters a little bit better. And by the time I finished drawing the book, my character designs look different than the cover. So I'm like, no problem. I'll just redraw the cover with the new character designs. And I went in and messed with some of the composition a little bit. And anyways, what happened was I was super excited to show everybody, like I redrew it, you know, here's the second version. This is a little bit better. This is what's going to actually be on the cover. Nobody liked it. Nobody liked it. Everybody's like, no, please, please do the original cover. And I was like, but the characters, they don't look like this. And even my kids were like, I posted a video on Twitter. They're like, Dad, there's like an intervention where my kids are just ripping on it. Like, no, here's what's wrong. This guy looks funky. This guy, you know, this person had a stupid look on their face. And, you know, so finally I relented and I went with the original design.
Didn't I tell you to go with the original too?
Nice.
No, so Will Terry, bless his heart, bless his sweet little heart. I showed him the cover before I showed anybody online as sort of like a, you know, just a, get the clearance because I wanted another artist's eyeball to look at it, right? Hey, what do you think of this? And he's on his way out and he looks at it and looking it up and down. He's all, yeah, that's cool. And I'm like, you sure? Yeah, it's great. It's good job. Okay, cool. Thanks. And he leaves and I post it and I come back and I'm like, hey, everybody hates this. And he's all, yeah, I didn't want to tell you.
It's the only way that I could get back at you for all the all the wonderful critiques you've given me.
I have not done anything. I've treated you in the highest regard. Everything you've done.
I feel bad about that. What's funny is now whenever you ask me for a critique, you're like, okay, don't give me the fake critique. Give me the real thing. So now I'm like, let's see. This is going to come back on me if I don't tell him everything.
I don't want to speak anything. Well, there is a big value of having people around that will, that you respect, that will give you the honest feedback, you know. It's hard to do that, hard to have that, because you know we know how much of a letdown it is when we're presenting the work. Right.
Yeah.
I think it's important for artists to realize too how important it is to get help with your art. Like we treat our art like it's super personal and it's all on our shoulders. But like if I look at the best stuff that I've done, I've usually had a review process with friends. With you guys, with people online, with family, and especially with like concepts with art directors and editors and stuff. And so I think we get in that mode of like, I want to go into my secret lair and create this thing and then show it to the world and have everybody love it. But I think often we're missing that. One of the reasons why it fails is because we don't let other people in to the process.
I agree. Anna Davis Court, I want to throw this out there that Anna Davis Court, she and I are working on this book together. I'm her mentor for a book that she's writing right now through Adobe. And she's one of the residents for Adobe. And so she got this year-long gig and she and I are working together. And she's already just such a fantastic artist. I mean, she just has naturally good instincts. She does things well the first time. And, you know, we've been working together on this book for about 8 months. And looking back on it now, the book is so good now. And it's because she and I just have this open dialogue and I trust her and she trusts me. And we couldn't have gotten there, I think, without the feedback. Mm-hmm. But she was already so good. And so I don't think there's any point in your career where that stops.
That's right. Yep. And when it does, you end up making the prequels to Star Wars.
I guess so.
I mean, isn't that the scuttlebutt?
Yeah, pretty much. Is that they could have been? Oh boy, I have a complicated relationship.
Oh, no,
with the prequels.
So you're not qualified.
But the story goes.
You love everything Star Wars, no matter what.
I can critique a thing too, but Star Wars. As well, but yeah, like Lucas surrounded himself with yes men, and that's why the prequels did not land like they should have with audiences. Hmm.
Ironically, you have to surround yourself with people that are willing to tell you no.
Right, and that's what happened in the original trilogy. Is he was trying to do stupid stuff, and like his wife was like, George, no, we're not doing that. I'm cutting that part out. We're going to do it this way. And so he's like this great idea man. And also in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, he didn't direct them himself. And so he kind of let the directors do their thing. Hmm. He wrote the story, but the directors brought a lot to it too. And then prequels, he was like one man show. Like, I'm going to write it. I'm going to direct it. All that stuff. So I think being able to put yourself in a position to be critiqued and then listen to those critiques is a good way to circumvent some failures as well. Or if there is a failure to use it as a, like we're saying, like a stepping stone towards success, like that book.
It's hard to use.
Better to have a small failure than have a medium or big failure later, kind of is what you're saying in a way too.
I would also say it's hard at the time of failure to see it as a great tool, as you know what I mean? That'll be something that will help you in the future because you're often caught up in the emotions of that failure. But if I look back, like I created a whole list of failures for this podcast that we won't get to talk about, which is cool because I wanted to be overprepared. But if I look at the list of them in general, each one of them hurt like crazy at the time of failure. And I was definitely not thinking like, this is going to really help me in the future. But every single one of them did. You know?
Give us one or two. Okay.
I'm glad you asked.
I've got a bunch. Go ahead.
In general, I can combine some together. And one aspect, in the beginning of my career, I would get, an art director would contact me and say, hey, we've got this project. We're looking at a bunch of illustrators. And you might be, are you willing? Are you available? This is something you would want to work on. So they're just sending out feelers. And in the beginning, it seemed like I would get one out of 10 of those. And my wife got to the point where she said, don't tell me when you're up for something because you never get it. And it's always a big job and it's going to make a difference in our lives. And then you don't get it. And then I hate you for not getting it. She didn't say that part, but she's like, it's just too disappointing. And one of those was, I'll tell you a couple of them. One was a book for the movie Madagascar. You know, they make the book for a lot of the children's book for the movie that comes out. Yeah. So was Madagascar Disney?
No,
the DreamWorks. So yeah, I was up for that book. I did a test piece. They loved it, or so they said, and I never heard anything again. Another one that was a real disappointment was, did you guys, I know you've seen this book by Peter, Paul, and Mary, the Puff the Magic Dragon, the actual book by Eric, what's his last name? Pie Beret. I don't know how to say his last name. It's the green dragon with the yellow lettering on the cover. And I got contacted by the same publisher to do the follow-up book to that, which was A Marvelous Toy by Peter, Paul, and Mary, which would have been really cool because even though they were before my time, that band, it would just be cool to say, I illustrated the book by, Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary. And I got really close to getting that one and I didn't get it. And it was really frustrating because the Puff the Magic Dragon book was selling like crazy. In fact, I just looked at it on Amazon. It's still selling really well, like 15 years later. I'm sure, it was a royalty deal. So I'm sure that, Eric got a royalty and I'm betting that he's seen some really nice royalty checks, but I'm looking at the Marvelous Toy. Who was illustrated. So Steve Cox got it. Steve Cox, if you're listening to this, congratulations. At the time, you ruined my life. But it's cool. And I see that it's not selling as well. And I'm not happy about that. I wish it were selling better than Puff the Magic Dragon. But
I mean, you bring up a really, really good point. I just wrote it down in my notes because I hadn't thought about that. But in this business, if you're not in the business yet, you're a student and you're studying it and all that, it seems like, the process goes, an editor calls you, a publisher calls you or emails you and says, do you want to do this? And you say yes, and then you do it. But what Will is saying there is so true, especially the first 5 years, that there's all these jobs that get talked about. I mean, this industry is full of talkers and proposals and all that stuff. And man, I don't know what percentage it is that doesn't get made, but it seems like the majority. And I was the same way, Will, like early in my career. And even when I first moved to Portland, I had a couple of books under my belt. I get all these proposals, same as you, and it wouldn't come through. I even had meetings with a couple of animation studios where it looked like they were going to do either an animated short or like a 30-minute kind of featurette kind of thing. And I was using my work and I'd come home all excited. They're going to make a movie. I'm making movies. And it was a done deal. I was already accepting the Oscar in my head. And you know what happened from those jobs? Nothing. I mean, like I even got an email that said, hey, we decided to go in a different direction or we're not doing this now. It's just like, radio silence. And it's really hard to deal with. Like you said, a 1 out of 10 ratio, that maybe even be optimistic for the early stuff of doing tests and not getting them and all that stuff. That is really tough. And it lasts quite a while up to the point where I think about 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, I got this job to do a book cover and then a bunch of illustrations on the interior. I think it was called How to Catch a Boggle or I think I sent it to you guys the other day. How to catch a boggle. Is that what it was? Boggle. Yeah. Okay. You guys can look it up. I did a sample piece for the interior and then a couple of sketches for a proposed cover. And I just really loved the story and was crestfallen when I didn't get the call. I thought it was just a no brainer. Like, okay, I'm going to be doing this book. You know, I'm already telling my wife I don't get it. And I wanted to do it so bad. And so those happened quite a bit.
These look like, it looks like the Hellquist books or the Lemony Snicket books.
How to Catch a Boggle book.
I mean, it's a totally different style than mine. So I can see why, if that's what they were going for, they didn't pick me. I mean, it makes sense. But I will say this, that I'm working with my agent now because I want to do more book covers. And she asked me what book cover I want to do. And I said, How to Catch a Boggle. I want to do the book cover anyway. Yeah. So that's the next one that I'm doing.
Oh, that's cool.
Because I wanted to do it.
The neat thing, too, is that yours would just look different. And unfortunately, right. We can't see the alternate universe to see which one, how it would affect sales. You know?
Right.
It'd be neat to be able to do
Mine would be better. Yeah.
It would be different. I mean, like, this is a nice cover. Yours would be a nice cover. And they would be totally two different takes, and they would be awesome either way. Yeah.
It's true. Which, this is a nice little segue because it goes into, I liked how Jake framed the different failures, that some are self-generated, some kind of happen to you from other people, and some are just dumb bad luck. Those are really good. It goes along with my medium level failure that for me is submitting all of these manuscripts. And I've probably done 8 maybe at this point, that I, you know, did a whole children's book, wrote the manuscript, did a whole dummy, got it all ready, sent it to my agent. We sent it out to publishers. It goes through the process called acquisitions. And you're right there. Same as Will and I were just talking about, where you're basically assuming the book's going to get published and then it just doesn't.
Oh yeah.
And it is such a letdown because it's a long term. It's not just doing a painting and it not working out. It's, you know, can cover 6 months of your life too. And you're, yeah.
Whew. Those are beyond your control.
How'd you get through it?
A lot of times where it's not even you. It's that they, for whatever, I mean, there's so many things that could happen at the publisher to where they, you know, all of a sudden they get sales statistics and they think, well, let's put our money behind this other book because we think, you know, maybe they got one that they think will sell better. Not that they thought yours would fail, just that they've got one that they think would sell even better. But they only have so much budget, yeah. So they cancel one and in favor of the other. And,
right. Or another book can come out at the same time that's similar to what you did, and all of a sudden it's going to just kill the...
Or it could be that your illustration is really bad.
It could be that too. Well, no, because they go through the acquisition, so that I know that the publisher's interested, and that's why if they would have just initially rejected it, it wouldn't have been as bad to me as it making it so far to almost being made. And then how do you guys get through that level of disappointment? Like, you just spent 6 months on something, it didn't really work out. Jake doesn't know what we're talking about here, Will.
Oh, I've got like 3 different failures sitting right here.
You're going to be light level.
Let's hear them.
All right. So
that one time where someone didn't like my piece?
Okay, so I remember... I was at Blue Sky Studios and I was working in the art department as a background designer. And so my job was to design a set and that the characters would be acting in. And there's this like unspoken hierarchy, right? Where the character designers are up on top, and then you've got like the people who do the paint, like the color and the get to design, like the textures and the painting for these characters. And then it just goes down from there. And I was sort of at this lower level, right? And I wanted to be a character designer. And so I got thrown a bone. The director is like, hey, we've got a few of these background characters and we need you to just take a few passes at it. And I was all, sweet, this is it. This is my chance to shine. And I'm going to prove to them that I'm a good character designer, and then maybe I'll get more character designs and I could sort of, build out my portfolio as a character designer. And I totally dropped the ball. I fumbled it. I did the best I could do as a character designer and received beyond, basically. And so I realized, like, you asked, like, how do you recover from that? Where do you go from there? And what I realized was, okay, maybe my character designs or the way that I design characters isn't good for this animation studio or for animation in general, but it told me that I wanted to move into a place where my character designs could be appreciated by someone. And so that meant doing more of my own comic books and my own children's books and things like that, where the design didn't need to meet the standards that that a animation studio has, but could basically find the audience that appreciates it. And so that's what I did. And since then, you know, do I get job offers for character design all the time? No, not really. But do I enjoy designing characters and drawing comics and doing things like that? I do. And when people think of Jake Parker, they don't think of me as a character designer, and I'm okay with that. But I just go out there and do the best I can with
when you say didn't meet their standards, so you went off and did your own thing. Are you saying that you felt like it was just a style problem? Like they would never hire you to be a character designer, not because of your ability to design a character, but just that the style was not what they were looking for? Or was it that you weren't at the level of drawing and designing?
I think it's just a handful of those things. Like it's a little bit of all that. Maybe now I'm a much more experienced artist, and if I was thrown that same bone, I'd probably do a better job, maybe. But at that time, I just wasn't up to snuff. My work wasn't good enough.
But there's the flip side of that too, is that I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent, but that's kind of what this podcast is about, right? Tangents. but I met a guy, I don't want to name his name because he was a Disney animator, and he did fit in. He did design characters for Disney. He did, he worked, for, I believe 15 years, 12 or 15 years for Disney out in California. And then, when he decided to leave because he wanted to do his own things, he couldn't find his own style. He said everything led back to Disney. So do you feel lucky at all that maybe you weren't a good fit for them because your stuff is your own? Have you ever thought about that?
I guess that's a good way to frame it. I guess the ultimate validation for your work is that a studio wants to use your style for the characters and the animation that they're making, So because your style is different and doesn't look like anybody else's, they want to use you for that.
Right.
So that's usually why they go, sometimes they do cast a wide net. And if you look at the art of books, you'll see, 100 different passes at a character design before they land on the style that they want. But typically, there's a handful of go-to people in the industry that they know what they're getting, they know what they want, and my work's just not it's not that, and I'm okay with that. I'm cool with that, and I've put my effort and my emotion and my interest into doing projects where I enjoy them, and basically at the end of the day, like, I get satisfaction from them. And if they find an audience that gets that same satisfaction, all the better.
You guys have anything that you can think of? So those are great stories, actually, Jake. I mean, it's fine. You're basically saying find what you are good at. You're not going to be good at everything. And so that failure kind of led you to be so kind of self-accepting on where you're supposed to land. I've kind of done the same thing with my style too. That's kind of how I've gotten comfortable doing what I do. Instead of rendering or doing more detailed kind of realistic paintings, I'm just so comfortable you know, found where I'm happy, whether that works or not. I'd like to talk about high level failures. Do you guys have any, what I consider a high level failure is a earth shattering, you know, you have to move, you got fired. Big level failures.
I mean, I think I've mentioned this before on this podcast, but this might not completely fit the bill, but I felt it like it did. I felt like it did at the time. I was getting illustration work on a regular basis, but I wasn't getting as much as I had in the past. And this was in 2006 and 7, leading up to the recession, the big housing crash in 2008. And that's when my wife got sick, and it's hard to be honest with yourself. I mean, it just is, right? Like when you screw up,
sure,
it's hard to say all of my problems are my fault. When in reality, sometimes that's the healthiest thing you can do. So we were living. She was teaching school, and we were living on my illustration and her teaching salary. And we were spending everything we made pretty much. And so when she got an autoimmune disease and couldn't teach anymore, we lost her income. And as a result, we were struggling financially on my illustration work, which I was getting good assignments, enough to live on if we were living within our means. But since we were extended, all of a sudden things started becoming a real problem, paying some of the bills and stuff. And I remember the area that we lived in California, there were a lot of people living around us that were doing really well. And, you know, I look across the street and see new vehicles, and one guy was putting in a pool, and I just remember feeling really sorry for myself that, like, you know, I've worked, I knew that I was a hard worker. There were times in my illustration career where I was working, you know, 6 days a week, 12 to 14 hours a day, because I just had tons of work, making tons of money, six figures for many years, with just freelance illustration. And I didn't have anything to show for it. And we were going through this real hardship. And I felt like I was a failure. I felt like I was failing my family. I felt like I was letting them down. And I just didn't know what to do. And I almost quit and became a prison guard. Have I talked about that on this podcast?
What?
Have I told you that? I guess not. Yeah. So
oh my gosh. I have a whole different view of you now.
I would have been that guy, you know. All the guys around me, I've talked about this on my YouTube, but I couldn't remember if I had talked about it on this podcast, but apparently not, because you didn't know about it. But all the guys around me were prison guards. COs, correctional officers, as they call them, and making six figures doing that. And, you know, their wives had jobs. And so they were making decent money and living in the Central Valley of California that was actually really affordable on that salary. And I just remember thinking, these guys went to high school. They got out of high school. They didn't do any college like I did. And they didn't start a business like I did. They didn't work. Well, they have to work long hours sometimes, but it's mind-numbing work, you know, standing a post. And I thought, I'm more like a dentist. That's what I think illustrators are a lot like dentists, right? Like, we had to study for a long time. We had to perfect our craft. And then that's what we're doing every day. We're using our hands, dentists using their hands. So I'm like, I should be making more money. What's that? Yeah. I remember feeling really sorry for myself because I just didn't, you know, and I wasn't honest enough to say we got ourselves into this situation. We should have been able to, you know, live within our means and not, you know, be going through this financial thing. So yeah, I went and took the class PC 832 in California. If anybody out there knows about that class, it's a class you have to take. And before you can become a correctional officer, I applied, I got my date to go to be hired. So unofficially hired. In other words, I had a spot that was mine, had my name on it. All I had to do was wait another 6 weeks, and then I was going into the academy. And everybody that goes in the academy is already hired. So, yeah, that was my life. And then I got scared because I started talking to the correctional officers in my neighborhood, and they were trying to talk me out of it. And I don't want to, I won't bore you with all the horror stories that they told me, but it became real, and it got really scary on the actual things that can happen to you in there. And I mean, I have a lot of respect for those guys because they've dealt with a lot, and it's a harsh place and a harsh thing to put yourself, like, you're locked in there. In many ways, you have, as a correctional officer, less freedom than the inmates, because, you know, you have to behave a certain way and they don't necessarily have to, you know? So anyway, that's my brush with almost becoming a correctional officer. And at the time, I looked at it as a complete failure. Like, I've spent all this time working as an illustrator. At that point, I was into illustration about 15 years as a professional. So, I mean, like, a well-developed career in illustration. You know,
that was so weird
to be basically admitting that I'm done. I failed. I did this thing. It didn't work out. I talked to a couple guys that were correctional officers, and they had full careers. One guy as an electrician, another guy as a plumber. And I was interviewing everybody I could that I knew that was doing that job. And they're like, yeah, as soon as the recession started hitting, you know, I couldn't make enough money with my electrician business anymore. And so it just felt like giving up. It felt like I'd never met anybody that was like, I love my job. I take pride in it. I love showing up to the prison every day. Everybody was like, I can't wait till I put in my 20 years and I can retire at 90% or 80% of my 80% of my salary. And
so how did you get yourself out? You're feeling bad. You're going through this prison thing. And what happened? How did you?
I talked to my wife.
Not do that.
I talked to my bishop at church. He talked me out of it. The correctional officers, the woman that lived next to me was a nurse at the prison. She was trying to talk me. It was like no one was talking me into it.
Tell him what your bishop said to you.
He said, "Will, I know what you're capable of doing. I know. I've seen your children's books. I know what you're doing in this world, and the gifts that you have should not be squandered in this way. Like, you've already developed this thing that can really help people in ways that you won't even be able to measure yourself. You'll never know, but you'll be taking something basically from the world if you give up." And that meant a lot to me, you know? And so we talked to my wife is from Utah here. And so we kind of talked to her family and, you know, they were very encouraging about us coming back. And it was basically a huge leap of faith. Is in the end, it was like, we're going to come back there and we're going to make it work. The cost of living is about the same. So it's not like we were saving any money, but we were just going to try to downsize and just live within our means. And we did.
When I think about you making that decision, and had you done the other decision, like, I've seen people talk to you about how much your YouTube channel has helped them, and I've seen people like thank you for like all the information that you've given and that you've put out there. And I see, like, at Comic-Con, I see the people like laughing and enjoying like what you've put out there with your little drawings, the fan art. And I'll even go here, like, you've had a positive impact on my life as well. So that decision to go ahead and stick with it, even though everything was pointing at you not to do it, is like, I'm super grateful for it.
So, well, thanks.
Thank you, Will Terry.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. How long did it take before you realize, kind of, you breathe a sigh of relief where you're like, okay, I'm glad I didn't take that road? How long did it take you to get traction?
We started gaining traction, but we bought a house that was too big. The rest of the story is we we screwed up further here in Utah and bought a house that was too big. We bought a house with the help of a, it's a long story, with a friend as a kind of an investment where he basically put the money down and we ended up losing that house. And I've talked about that before on my podcast. So we just like, we struggled for about a good 6 or 7 years financially. And then just through trial and error and all these, this list of failures and the few successes was enough to not only pull us out, but we could, you know, put 20% down on our last house or the house we're in now, pay cash for our cars and put money in savings. And, you know, so we're in a really good spot right now. But it really took learning to live within our means. And I know I preach that a lot on my YouTube channel, which is, you know, like, I think we talked about in the last episode a little bit on like when you feel like you should have certain things because other people have certain things, physical things, that's, in my opinion, that's not a good, healthy way to think. You know, like just because someone else has an iPad and they're drawing on it and you really want one, if you can't afford it, you can't afford it. And it'll cost you later on if you buy it on credit or you buy it when you can't really afford it. And these are things that I struggled with. And when we got into trouble financially, I remember always saying, well, it's for the business, you know, it's for the business. It's a write-off.
Right.
I can get it because it's a write-off. And I got a lot of things that I shouldn't have gotten and blamed it on the business. And so that's one of the things that I am big on preaching right now is, you know, really living below your means so that you can save money every month. Because there will be lean times, you know. There's always going to be right. lean times. If there's good times, guess what? It's going to change. And when I was making six figures year after year, I had less money than I do, well, now, you know, and just because of how we were spending, you know. And I don't know if anybody out there knows the artist Kerry Henry, but he told me when we were making really good money, because he was making really good money, he says, I really hope you're putting a lot of this away. And we weren't putting any away. He goes, because this ain't going to last.
Oh, no.
And this was in the kind of the heyday of the editorial illustration, you know, magazine, newspaper illustration. And I was getting so much work that I was turning down. I would keep a calendar and I was turning down about 10 to 15 jobs a month. And I was taking about 15 to 20 jobs a month. And I counted up the year I peaked and made, I think our top year was 136,000. I turned down about $80,000 of work that year. You know, and I just felt like it was going to last forever. Like, why would it stop? You know,
mm-hmm. Right. There's no reason for it to change.
And when he told me that, I was sick because we were so in debt in making all that money. It was so ridiculous.
Well, me and Will definitely agree on that. I am so anti debt there's so much flexibility. I mean, we talked about it in other podcasts, but there's just so much that comes with not being living that kind of lifestyle, including some happiness, I think, and not being beholden to all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I've got Jake. You have any big high level knockdown failures?
Did you
ever
become a prison guard, Jake?
Hey, by the way, Will, you got to start treating Jake like a prisoner in the day, in the studio. Come in and yell at him, make him do push-ups. Do they do that in jail?
We're a little over time, but I will. Yeah. Can we finish out with this one?
Do we have a time? Isn't this on the interwebs? Can't we go for like 4 hours if we want to?
I got people calling me, and I can't be listening.
You have failed at the podcast on failure.
Well, I'm trying to think which failure would be better. Okay, there was a time where. When I quit my job at the animation studio to pursue a career as an independent artist, and I thought I had everything squared away and lined up. And what it was I needed a, a good transition job, a job that I didn't have to be there 40 hours a week so that I could take a day or 2 days where I could focus on personal projects and publishing projects and things like that. And I got this job working for BYU as an illustration professor, or I don't know, instructor, I guess is the word. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, this is the perfect opportunity. So I quit the job. BYU hired me. I still had benefits, health benefits, and I was able to take off 2 days out of the week to work on my publishing work and really spend some time like building up my like independent career. Okay. So things were kind of going along smoothly. We bought a house out here, but the whole time I was like, this nagging thing, like you're quitting a job, like a perfectly good job in a recession. This was 2010 when I quit, and you're quitting a job that like people are really, really want to have. And isn't that like ungrateful of you to do that? But I was like, no, I'm moving forward. I'm moving in the direction that I want to go in. And so this is like a necessary thing. And so I worked for BYU for about a year, and then that job vanished. It vaporized. And one of the things was, and this is partly my fault, is they didn't want to keep me on because I never got a college degree. And they're like, you know, if we want to advance you to the next level and keep you working here, you're going to have some sort of degree in art. And I looked at the numbers and I was like, I could go to school for the next 2 years, get this degree, and then go back to working for BYU and make, you know, X amount of dollars and still only have 2 days a week where I could work on my personal stuff, or I could just quit and like go at it. And so I decided to like quit and go at it and not do the degree thing. And no, I just had zero work. I had zero opportunities. And nothing was happening. And it got to the point where like no income was coming in, and we had spent the savings that we had to put the down payment on the house. And so like there was like nothing there, and we had food storage, right? So we had like beans and oats and rice that we had saved up in case of emergency, and this was the emergency. And so like we were going through and we were eating that, and the kids were like, beans again? I'm like, yeah, beans again. Beans are awesome, you know? They're a magical fruit, you know, trying to put on a good place. And here I was like, you know, trying to be this independent creator who has these publishing projects and all these things. And like even the publishing projects I had, like I just wasn't getting paid from them, because sometimes, you know, the payment for those, you can't, the publisher is sort of on their schedule when they pay you, right? And might not line up with your schedule for when you need money. And so what I had to do was go find a job. And so I went back to working, you know, a 40-hour a week job. And I said, I'm going to give myself a year at this place. And I'm going to take that year to get all my ducks in a row so that I can work for myself and have all the work lined up that I need. At least 6 months worth of work lined up is what I wanted, so that in those 6 months while I'm working, I can work on getting work for the next 6 months. And I knew if I could just, you know, lay down pipe in that way, that things would eventually work out. And the year came and went, and I didn't have 6 months work lined up. I was really stressed. I was really down on myself because I was like, you know, you're not doing what you said you'd do, and you're not succeeding like you thought you'd succeed. And so I doubled down even harder. I thought maybe the problem is I'm not focusing enough on getting my name out there with social media. And so I doubled down on social media, and I started posting daily and trying to post really good art daily. And about 3 months after my year, the year time that I gave myself, I landed a really good job from Google. They hired me to, and that was going to carry us over for a couple months. They hired me to do some character design stuff, robots, not actual like real characters. And then I knew if I launched a Kickstarter, that would bring in a certain amount of money. And there was like two other things that fell into place. I think it was another children's book where I realized, and I added it all up, I realized, okay, I have enough money for the next 6 months to like pay for everything and for us to save a little bit and for things to be good. And so that's when I put in my 2 weeks notice. And that was 5 years ago. And I've been doing it ever since, and it hasn't been smooth, but it's been a steady trajectory, like upwards, right? Where, you know, if there is a step backwards, there's two steps forward. And I look back at that, and I think it would have been really easy just to throw in the towel all the way and say, okay, I've got another job now. I can just stay here for the next 10 years, and work for them and not have to worry. But I did have like this goal. I had this vision of what I wanted to do and what I wanted to be. And so I stuck with that. And now I feel like I'm in a pretty good spot. And I don't ever really look back and think what I should have done. I kind of feel like I did things the right way.
That's awesome.
Awesome. God, that's a great story.
Well, it goes to show you that
crazy.
You just don't know what the future is going to hold. You just, you know, you think you know what it's going to look like, and you kind of plan on it, but you got to be prepared for the curves that get thrown at you.
Yeah. You do. What I like about this episode, I mean, I guess we can start wrapping it up, and I don't want to wrap it up. You know, it's the whole episode on failure, so I don't want to leave people sad. So I kind of like to kind of break down what we've talked about, that you know, no matter how successful you get, that failure is just going to be a part of this life, and especially in artistic life. And even when you're successful, there's these mid-level failures and big level failures and small level daily failures that we all kind of weather. And it's not immune to, you know, once you hit a certain point, it doesn't mean that all of a sudden that stuff goes away. And I think that's important for people to know. And also that all the bad stuff typically has some kind of silver lining if you wait long enough and if you don't get too down during that phase.
Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty good. I think too, just also like look at every failure as an opportunity to learn, like what went wrong, what you could have done differently, and then actually use that to improve and to get better. Kind of like Groundhog Day, right?
Like, that's a great one. Yeah.
Like let those failures teach you. Let you know, if you learn nothing from it, then it is truly a failure. But if you're able to learn from it and improve your life to any degree from that, then mm-hmm. then you can turn that into a success. So
awesome.
All right.
Take us out.
Okay. Thanks for joining us, everybody. 3-Point Perspective is made possible by svslearn.com, where becoming a great illustrator starts. And your hosts today have been Will Terry, Lee White, and Jake Parker. That's me. Will Terry can be found at willterry.com, and you can follow him on Instagram at willterryart. This is his handle there. Lee White, check his website out at leewhiteillustration.com, and you can follow him at Instagram at Lee White Illo is what it is. And I'm Jake Parker. My website's mrjakeparker.com. And you can follow me on Instagram at Jake Parker. Podcast is edited by Alex Sugg. Check out his work at alexsugg.com. Show notes by Tanner Garlick. You can check out his artwork at tannergarlick.com. He's our in-house assistant and does an actual drawing for each one of these episodes. And they're pretty slick, but the notes, if there's anything you heard in this you want to read back over it, you want to catch a link to something that we mentioned, he's really good about doing some copious notes there. So if you like this episode, please share it around, throw out a link to it on Twitter, or mention it on Instagram or something. Just tell a friend in person, that'd be great. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, you can hear this on Spotify, wherever you're listening to it. If there's a place to leave a review, please leave a review. We'd love to hear what you think. And if you're wanting to join in on this particular discussion about failure, go to the svslearn.com forums, where we have posted this episode in its own thread. You could talk about it there with other artists. So yeah, chime in and let us know what you think. So thank you, everybody, and we will see you next time.